Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. The sun is shining. Yay, the rain stopped. It's beautiful outside. Kind of hot, but we don't care. This is going to be fantastic because we have author Jeff Bond here, and Black Quest 40 has taken the spotlight today. This book is a must-read. Everybody has to read it because Just Reviews thinks this is one of the top ones for 2019. So let me give you a little hint from my book review. When all is said and done, and the final programs, bot lists, and computer programs are spilling out, will the ending be positive or negative for those involved in a training session for Black Quest 40? A lot of technical research, a lot of technical language, as author Jeff Bond brings everyone into the world of the 21st century in a different way. I really enjoyed that part. So good morning. How are you? And welcome back
to
MJ Network.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, Fran. I appreciate it. I'm well.
That's good. So Deb Bollinger has no time for corporate training. She's so like me. Seriously. So, I mean, yeah, you know, you don't want to go with the garbage. You want to just, like, get the job done, whatever. So tell us about Deb and her special skills and why she decided to work for CodeWise.
Yeah, so Deb Bollinger is kind of a software engineering and robotics savant. She, despite kind of being raised in difficult circumstances in San Francisco, she grew up homeless with a mother who was schizophrenic. She overcame a lot of difficult circumstances, and she went to MIT at the age of 16. She got a PhD from Harvard and then went to Google, and she kind of became one of their top guns there. And so she's got a lot of these kind of tech props, great programmers. She builds all these robotic gizmos that she built in college and grad school and then professionally. But after a while working at Google, it kind of got to be a little repetitive. I think she didn't think she didn't feel like she had enough creative freedom. She didn't really feel like she was doing things that she was passionate about, because she's somebody who is very passionate about advocacy and issues. So she jumped ship from Google to work for this smaller tech firm called CodeWise, which is the setting, this CodeWise solutions company is the setting for the whole story of Black Quest 40.
Yeah, I know. I didn't know what the book was about, but I knew you wrote it. So when Cheryl said, would you do the blog tour? I go, yeah. No problem. I can do that. And I knew it was going to be different than the other one. But the other one was
really good,
too.
It is a very kind of a different story than my first one, The Wintermaker.
That one, too.
Yeah. It's just, I kind of wanted to write something in a corporate setting. I worked at kind of a 9-to-5 job for many years myself. And I wanted to put some kind of a thrill or something that would be a fun read inside of this corporate setting and kind of explore some of these issues of, you know, the ridiculousness of corporate training and, you know, the falseness of a lot of these corporate types. And I wanted to come up with kind of a fun, propulsive way to tell a story in that setting. And so this is Black Quest 40 is the result of that, really.
You did. And you know what I appreciated? It wasn't a terrorist attack. Seriously.
Right.
I've read too many of them, and
Right.
So who owns this company, and explain the training session? Oh, this was really scary. Why did they lock everybody down, and what did it entail? And Deb, well, she's a rebel, so after me, really.
Right. So Black Quest 40 is the name of a corporate training exercise that the owners of this company called CodeWise Solutions come up with. And I think at the beginning of the story, CodeWise Solutions is a big tech firm. They do kind of software optimization and different they work for different clients. And at the beginning of the story, they're struggling. They're losing customers. They're not making as much money as they want. And so the story that Deb and the other Code Voice employees get is that they need to do this really intensive corporate training called Black Quest 40, where they're going to lock down the office for 40 hours. Nobody can leave the office in 40 hours. Nobody can email out. Nobody has access to the Internet. And they're going to confiscate everybody's cell phones so they can just focus on this training exercise. And it's meant to be this, you know, sort of typical rah-rah team building. And, you know, we're going to build this crisis ability to do these, you know, projects, these impossible projects on really short timelines. And it seems, you know, like a fantastic, you know, ridiculous thing that they would try to do. But I think in the world of big tech, you know, out in San Francisco, and some of the things that these companies try to do with packing all these hours onto these, you know, peon employees, I think it's the kind of crazy thing that somebody like Elon Musk or that might try to do. And so as the book starts, CodeWise is, the office is in this kind of lockdown mode. Deb shows up in the morning, thinks she's going to do something else, and, you know, she gets this company-wide email. We have this, you know, we have this corporate training coming up starting right now. Nobody can leave the office for 40 hours. You know, these trainers have brought in cots. They've got caterers. They're going to bring you meals. You know, we'll auto-respond to all your emails and let people know that you're busy with the training. But 40 hours, we're going to do this impossible software project that you're going to find out about at this meeting this morning, and we're just going to go with it. So, and, you know, I know as somebody who worked in a corporate setting, you know, corporate training can feel like that in miniature. I mean, it feels so ridiculous. And, you know, everybody's looking around at each other. Why are we here at corporate training? Why did they make us do this? And so Black Quest 40 is really kind of blowing that out, you know, playing the scenario forward to really to hopefully kind of fun, intense heights.
No, my husband would know what you're talking about because he worked in a company that used to do corporate training, and they used to, the guy was like on a video, on a screen, you know, Skype kind of thing.
Right, right.
And they had to sit there for like 10 hours falling asleep. It was like, oh, my God, I can't understand that.
Yeah.
So we've got Deb, and you've brought a very, very important issue out. A lot of people are bringing the issue of homeless, which is fantastic. So she was creating a thing for homeless people to be able to access beds. How would this happen? And then in the middle of the training, she gets a you know, text or something that this guy, you know, needs her. So what does she do? And why did you bring that in? Because I really like this. That point.
Right. So as I mentioned, you know, Deb grew up homeless, and advocacy and social issues are very important to her. And there's this conflict within Deb where, you know, she works at Google, she works at CogoEye Solutions, you know, she kind of does the corporate thing as her job, but she really, what she's really passionate about is are these side projects, and the biggest one of those side projects is Airbnb, and it's an app. In the story, as I've created it, it's an app where a homeless person would wear a wristband. They would maybe have kind of a map display, and they could look around the city and see where there were available beds. So Deb, before the events of the story, she goes around and she rustles up volunteers, people who have an extra bed, a guest room in their house or their apartment. Of course, we're in San Francisco, most people in apartments. So she gets these volunteers who have extra beds, and if they sign up for their place, their extra bed to appear on these maps, you know, of these of her app, Airbnb, and then homeless people can log in and they can see, oh, I've got these available beds. They can sign up for one, and then for a night they can go to this person's house or apartment and sleep there. So as the story starts, Deb is launching Airbnb. This is the first night that homeless people are wearing her wristbands that she spent all this time designing. They're going to be able to log in, find, you know, spare beds. And so Deb, you know, even though she's at CodeWise Solutions, it's her 9-to-5 job, she's got to be there contractually. She's kind of watching her screen to see how Airbnb is doing because this is the first day of her app. So early in the story, right after she has found out that Black Quest 40 is locking down the office and no one's allowed to leave, she becomes aware that there's an issue with Airbnb. Something's not quite working right with the map of available beds for homeless people. So she tries to go leave. You know, she said, she heard that there's a campus quarantine and she's not supposed to leave, but, you know, come on, this is corporate America. I mean, what does that really mean? We're not supposed to leave. So she tries to leave, and Elite Development, which is the name of the corporate training firm that they've brought in to be in charge of the corporation, they stop her. They've got all these kind of yellow-shirted, they call them facilitators, for the exercise that are at all the exits. And as Deb tries to leave, you know, they say, stop, you can't go. And she says, oh, whatever, you know, I'm not listening to you, you know, you corporate training, you know, drone or whatever. And so she tries to walk out, and the person physically stops her and drags her back inside, and she just can't believe it. She's aghast that they're going to try to pull this on her. And, of course, as the story goes on, it gets a lot worse and a lot more intense, the dispute between her and the corporate trainers.
I know, and I prayed for her that she – my question is this, though. They have they have beds in people's houses. And I'm thinking during that the story, how safe is that? Because they don't know, you know, these homeless people don't know them. So how safe is that to do something that?
Right. And I think that's one of the things that Deb starts the story, she's maybe a little more naive and kind of she has the idea that tech can solve everything. You know, she's not a bad people person, but I think as someone who grows up in technology and coding and robotics, she believes that, you know, she can solve problems with technology. And so she really designs the system and says, oh, it makes perfect sense. You know, person needs a bed. Other people have a bed.
Yeah.
And it all kind of works out. I think the reality is, as you or anybody, you know, with a broader perspective probably would anticipate, it's not going to be that easy. As the story goes on, at the end, you know, we do kind of find out, I think I can say this without giving away too much about the plot, we can find out the things that didn't go as well with Airbnb as she hoped. And I think that issue, I mean, you know, we could go down the rabbit hole there, but I do think, you know, you could imagine that you could have some kind of feedback system, just like, you know, with Uber or anything else or Airbnb, you know, there's a way to kind of have a reputation or get ratings or do some kind of pre-certification. And I think you would definitely have to have some kind of a system in place if we're going to kind of dream and imagine that we actually would do Airbnb. And I've had people say that to me after I give them the book and they read it, say, oh, we've got to do this. You know, somebody should do this. You know, I think you'd have to do some steps at the beginning with hosts to verify that they were kind of good people. And there would have to be some protections the other way when you had homeless people or people that just needed a place for the night. There'd have to be systems and safeguards in place for sure, you know. And I think those are the kind of things that as the book moves forward, as Deb kind of goes forward with this project, she'd have to bring people in and develop some of those things. You know?
Yeah, she'd have to do some background checks on the people that, you know,
for sure,
have the beds. And you have to check to see that these homeless people were not mentally ill and arrested for that or anything like that.
Right,
because you don't know.
Definitely. Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh.
We have that up here in the West Side, and then people are complaining that they have to have extra guards and have to pay for them because there's a homeless shelter 2 blocks away from a very rich neighborhood. So what did they think they were creating? And tell us about Carter, Dawson, Kate, Paul, and Susan and their roles in this thing. So an awful lot of people that are in part of this thing.
Right. So so the leaders of CodeWise, the founders, the people who founded CodeWise Solutions are a group of three. They were all classmates at Carnegie Mellon, and they kind of got together as grad students and, you know, had this idea to make a company called CodeWise Development. There's three different, very different personality types. Susan Wright is the CEO of CodeWise, as the book starts. She's kind of a rock star. She goes to Davos and talks to executives from all over the world. She goes on CNBC and talks about all the great things that CodeWise Solutions is doing. You have Carter Katanchek, who is also one of the founders, and he's more of a slick sales guy. He goes around and probably sells the company to different investors. And then you have Paul Grib, who's the third one, who's a little more of the kind of the guy in the mind who built a lot of the technology. Not a very flashy character, and he's actually Deb's boss as the book begins. Even though Deb is kind of a rock star that they brought in from Google, she nominally has this boss, Paul, who she kind of has some disdain for. And the three of them, there's a little bit of a triangle dynamic there where the two, Susan and Carter, bought the stake of Paul Grib, the boss of Deb, and kind of, I don't want to say swindled, but they took his ownership ship's stake before it was worth very much. And so when the venture capital people came in and paid a bunch of money to Codewise for their ownership stake, Susan and Carter kind of got rich and Paul sort of got the shaft. So so Paul, Deb's boss, is a little bit, not exactly bitter, but he's a little ambivalent about his role. You know, he was a founder, but he didn't really get rich off of the company like Susan and Carter did. So anyway, so as the book begins, Susan is off. She actually is in Davos. She's kind of not there. And Susan is the one who recruited Deb to come work at Codewise. And so Deb really has a lot of faith in Susan, looks up to her as a woman in power in big tech, and doesn't think a whole lot of Carter Kachanchek, who's the CFO, because he's kind of a slickster corporate person who really just kind of gets under Deb's skin. He's just kind of got an oily personality, and she doesn't really jive with him. But Carter is the one who really conceives of this Black Quest 40. It's his baby. It's his idea to do this big training. And Carter is the one who goes out and finds Elite Development. To run the training show. And Elite Development is run by Jim Dawson and Katie Dawson, who turn out to be brothers and sisters. And their Elite Development is kind of this muscled up. They used to do some military kind of training, and then they've segued into corporate training. And Codewise is one of their first corporate clients. So they've got this really kind of tough, macho, we can do it, you know. You all are going to, you know, sort of conform to these deadlines and this my way or the highway approach, which Jim Dawson, the leader of Codewise of Elite Development, really embodies.
Well, no democracies in this company, that's for sure. Can tell
you
that.
No, it's definitely Dawson's way or the highway. Yeah, he actually walks around with this little stress ball that he pulverizes in his one hand throughout the book. Yeah,
I may borrow it because I have so many reviews to do. It's getting me well. I got 5 books this morning in the mail. Out of nowhere, 5 of them. Well, the good news is, everybody, Amazon just put your review. It's 5 stars on. They just said it was wonderful.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. I do appreciate it. every review
I just put
helps
it on my Facebook. Yeah, it's 5 stars and it's on. And Amazon said, thank you for reviewing it. How nice of them to accept my brilliance. Now, we're going to get back to Cecil. I like Cecil. What happens when she's supposed to meet with him, part of the homeless group? And how does she come to blows with the guard and makes it even more complicated? And she's clever. She explains herself. But, you know, she didn't want to leave poor Cecil hanging dry. So how does she handle that situation?
Yeah, so I think on the scene you're talking about, I think in that scene, I think she's going down to the parking garage, and Elite Development, the trainers, they have this big hulking van in the parking garage. And Deb, kind of early on in the exercise, you know, decides that there's something more than meets the eye here to this corporate training exercise. She just thinks the project can't be just a busy work assignment. There has to be something more sinister going on. So she goes down to the parking garage and investigating kind of has to break a couple of rules. And then she learns something that casts doubt on the cover story for Elite, you know, that kind of makes her believe that her hunch was right, that there is something else going on. And she is, you know, again, not to give away too much, but she is kind of confronted by somebody from Elite who uncovers her. And thankfully, there is a friendly person there who kind of intervenes in the dust-up. Her, which is her friend Cecil, who is a homeless man that she grew up, her mother knew as she was growing up on the streets of San Francisco, and Cecil has become important for her with Airbnb. He's kind of her kind of go-to authority on, you know, homeless problems. He is homeless himself, and so we do get to meet one of her clients for Airbnb, and Cecil is he comes in a very kind of high pressure, intense moment of the plot.
I think you should bring that ad back in the next book, seriously.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
See that for sure.
See that? My brilliance is working here. This is good. What can I say?
Yeah.
So, finally, you know, unfortunately, you have to go with the flow and you have to do what everybody else does. I don't do that, but that's beside the point. So why does she agree to participate? And her assistant, Prisha, she gets a feeling that there's something not right between the two of them. And I was got the feeling that she needed a stress pill, poor Deb. And Prisa was, you know, having her own issues. So why does she finally say, okay, fine, I'm going to do this? But basically, she really doesn't want to do it. And the way she does it, it's unique, that's for sure.
Yeah, so Deb, she definitely does not want to participate in the project. But I think what she comes to feel, she comes to believe that there's really no way for her to refuse to do it and not have a large negative impact on her coworkers and even on CareBNB. I think, you know, her boss, Paul Grimm, who, again, in the beginning of the story, she doesn't think a whole lot of, he kind of takes her aside and says, look, you know, if you refuse to participate in this at all, they're just going to set you aside. You know, you're not going to be able to do any investigating. You're not going to be able to keep tabs on CareBNB. And not only that, it's really going to hurt the other employees. And so Prisha is one of her employees. So Prisha works for Deb. And she's somebody who really starts to suffer the wrath of Elite Development, the trainers. You know, when Deb goes missing and goes to investigate in this van down the parking garage, a lot of the work is under pressure, and they don't come through with the deadline because, of course, they don't have their big gun Deb working on it. And so Prisha really gets chewed out in a way that's really nasty, and Deb overhears it, and she can't take it. She realizes that she's gotta play the trainer's game a little bit here if she wants to help out her coworkers. So she does go along with them. And I think Deb's relationship with the people she manages is another kind of interesting thing that I wanted to write about. I mean, she's not really a natural manager, you know, because she's got a lot of snark. Her attitude is not always great, but, you know, at least in terms of how a corporate person might see it, you know. So she kind of struggles to play it straight and do the best job she can managing her people. And so with Prisha, as you said, there can be a little bit of tension between the two of them. And I think Deb, as the book goes on, is kind of learning herself how to deal with people in this corporate setting that she doesn't really relish, and learning how to do right by the people that she works with, like Prisha.
I like that. That is true. And that's hard. So why does Deb think that this is somehow related to the Russians and it blows back to the owners? And why does she think it has something to do with the nuclear plant in Chernobyl? That was scary, let me tell you.
Yeah, I think I'm going to pass here. I don't want to say too much
about... Okay, you don't have to answer that one. We don't have to.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, now I want to leave out this question, too, about adversaries. Okay, when things get dangerous and she tries to escape, who helps her? And who comes to her aid? I mean, she gets into danger, and some of those acrobats that she does in the book is like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
She's in pretty
good.
I wouldn't even think about that. My goodness.
Right. So I think, you know, I definitely, as far as the, you know, the people coming to her aid, there's an unexpected character that comes to her aid at a very crucial time when she stopped. And I think that's a big moment for Deb's character. I mean, as I talked a little bit about her character and how her worldview kind of changes. I think at the beginning of the book, she's got a very black and white view. You know, Paul, her manager, is kind of a square. You know, the Elite Development people obviously are bad. I mean, as the book continues, I think there's no question that there are bad guys in the story. But even within that group, Elite Development, there is a character who she comes to feel like is a little more nuanced and has more to him, who's going to help her out. And I think that's a big part of her journey in the book, is understanding that, you know, she doesn't have all the answers, or she has a lot of answers, but maybe some of them are more complicated than she wants to believe. And so in order to get through this ordeal with Black Crest 40 and survive it and understand it and get to the bottom of it, she's going to have to stretch her own comfort limit and rely on people that maybe she doesn't have a lot of things in common with, and think a little bit outside of her regular perspective. And as the book ends, kind of the real bad guys have been revealed, and again, as I say, like the nuance to some of the other characters who she didn't think were that good are revealed. You know, she has a real reckoning where she's got to say, well, you know, these people that helped me out were not the people that I thought might have helped me out. You know.
I just got an email from Cheryl. She said that for some reason, I don't know why she's having trouble hearing you. I'm not having trouble at all. She said you're sort of breaking up, so maybe it's just the way, I don't know. So what will happen to CodeWise if they don't meet the deadline? And where is the money coming from, and who's going to get it?
So CodeWise solution. So if the deadlines aren't met, and Elite Development, the training company, has a lot of intermediate deadlines. I mean, the whole project has been done in 40 hours, but you know, every few hours they've got a checkpoint, and they've got these kind of red countdown timer clocks throughout the office. So if certain deadlines aren't met, Elite Development starts taking away things like stock options. They start to limit employees' movement through the office. They say, well, if you've fallen this far behind this checkpoint, you have to stay at your desk. We're not going to let people wander around the office and walk around other people's workstations. They even talk at one point about injecting people with stimulants to increase productivity. So it gets pretty wild. All the things that they say. And as the story goes on, we even learn that there are larger stakes for the CodeWise Solutions company itself. You know, there are greater financial stakes than even we know at the beginning. Beyond just the personal consequences of failure for the employees of CodeWise, there's also this pretty cataclysmic consequence if the company doesn't, as a whole, finish this software product in the 40 hours.
You know which character I like the best?
What's that?
I can't believe this. I like Hedgehog Eleanor Roosevelt, the drone, and Haven. I'm sorry. I love these characters because she actually were useful. So why does she need Hedgehog? Hedgehog's cool. You got to bring Hedgehog and the drone and Raven back. So what happens when Raven takes a powder? But who are these characters and how did you create them? That created a lot more interest, let me tell you. It made it really different.
Right. So, you know, Black Quest 40, you know, of course, as a lot of people have mentioned, it has kind of a diehard theme to it. And so, you know, in Die Hard, Bruce Willis just kind of uses his fists or whatever, throwing chairs through windows and things like that. And I really wanted to do something fresh and different for Deb. So, for Deb's character, she's got a lot of grit and determination, but she also uses a lot of these little gizmos that she's built in her robotics training to get at the bad guys. And one of them is Raven, as we talked about, is a drone. Mm-hmm. It's like a quadcopter drone that goes around inside and kind of follows her around, and it's almost like a little digital pet, you know, that can do her bidding and go to meetings for and things like that. Hedgehog Eleanor Roosevelt is another. It's almost like a little handheld computer that she's built out of an old bike helmet. And it's not a very powerful computer, but when CodeWise and Elite take away everybody's cell phone and limit everybody's ability to use their workstations for things, she's got to use Hedgehog Eleanor Roosevelt, in different ways as a flashlight or, you know, to sneak into the CodeWise van in all these different ways. So she's got the little handheld computer. She's also got things like she's got these little Hot Wheel cars that are remote controlled that she can access through the network. She's got these mechanical dragonflies that can fly around and spy for her. So she has all these little gadgets that she uses in the course of the story, and she's going to have to use them all to get past these corporate trainers.
Well, obviously, they don't know she has them, which makes it even great, and I think everybody else would like to have them, too.
Right.
They're for spying people. So there's a word that I think everybody wants to define. What are botlets, and what happens when they realize they're not succeeding and they may not get there on time? And I don't know. I don't know if I want to be there if they don't make it. Seriously.
So botlets are, it's kind of a jargony word for these little code objects in the software that Deb and her coworkers are building. They kind of go in and sneak in and do the hacking and the changing of the software that the program requires. I don't want to go into too much detail.
No, don't.
Actually, I have a few people, and in fact, Deb would be much better than me at explaining. But because I do have people that, you know, kind of tune out with too much of the technical stuff, and that was one of the challenges in writing the book, was to include enough technical details that people felt that it was authentic and that Deb was authentically an expert and somebody that was believable as a person that could pull off all the things that she does over the course of the story, and yet have the story not be so dragged down with technical details that people just kind of tuned it out and said, well, I don't know what that's about, and just want to kind of shut the books. So that's about as much as I probably ought to say about botlets before making everybody bored. Yeah.
So what happened? This scene got me. I got so scared. Let me tell you. Some of the scenes that you described, I could actually see the person climbing and in the ducts, and I'm going like, how the devil? She must be as skinny as I am. I weigh 107 pounds or nothing. So I'm saying, you know, what happens when she's chased, and how did you create the scene in the ducts? I mean, there's someone that helps her, but oh my God, I would get more than claustrophobia, acrophobia, and worse, hydrophobia, and
yeah,
all of those.
I definitely couldn't do that either. I'm somebody who's a little bit claustrophobic. But, yeah, there are a couple points in the story where Deb has to go up into the HVAC ducts of the building. And,
yeah,
I mean, I did a lot of looking around at schematics and measurements of office building ventilation systems and talked to people in the industry a little bit to know what would be possible. I mean, Deb is kind of small in stature, so I think that helps, and that gives her an advantage over the CodeWire or the elite people who are mostly these kind of hulked up ex-military types who can't really move around in the ducts very well. So, I did have to kind of educate myself about how do ducts run above a ceiling, how do they run between floors and things like that. So it was, and I know that there are different action movies that use ducts, and who knows how realistic or not realistic they are, but I did the best I could to kind of get some accurate descriptions there of the way that you would enter a duct and the way you would, you know, move around there and what it would feel like to be in the duct. You know, would it be dusty? You know, would it be loud when you fell to the side? Or, you know, what are the different things that, you know, how would it feel to be up in there and sneaking around in the ducts?
She's lucky she didn't get stuck.
Yeah,
my God.
That's for sure, yeah.
She has to be little like me. I mean, seriously, I wouldn't do that. I would just say, you know, somebody else do that for me and pay them.
Right.
But before I forget, Tuesday, New York Times author Jason Allen's going to be here with East End. On the 29th, the best lousy choice I've made will be Jim Nesmith. On the 10th, and I might ask you to join me on one of these shows, it's a panel show with Vincent Zandri, Matt Coyle, Larry Thompson, and Alan Topol. We're going to talk about the different types of publishing and Fran's greatest gripe, books that are written with fonts that she can't see. I've gotten a few books that I've told the authors I'm not reading it because the font is so small I can't see it on my pinky. And what can I say? And on the 16th, Buried in the Stacks with Marilyn Levinson, a.k.a. Alison Brooke, The Black Nowhere with Reese Hirsch on the 18th, and somebody's book that is so scary, it's really scary, Gretchen, Shannon Kirk. And that's just some of what's happening in September. It gets even better in October, and I have to announce this because I was in shock yesterday. On October 15th, Fran is going to interview John Land and Donnie Brasco, and the book is called Capital White, and it's an Audible. For those of you that like Audible, I have it printed out. So if you want to know more about Donnie Brasco and being an undercover FBI agent, tune in. It should be interesting. So explain the roles of Dawson and Carter, and what happens when she hacks into their systems and finds out the hidden truth. That's all I'll say.
Right. So Jim Dawson is the leader of Elite, as we said, and Carter Katanchek is kind of the CFO, the sort of slick sales guy at Deb's company. And they're kind of the two principals because they're the ones who got together and made the original deal between Elite and CodeWise. It's their project. It's their idea that this is going to really move the company forward. So as the book starts, you know, they're the two representatives of the corporate training, one on the company side and one on the trainer side, and they're kind of standing side by side. They're optimistic. They're talking about all the good things that are going to come out of the exercise. And then, of course, as the story progresses and as the company falls behind and it looks like they may not build the software, there gets to be a strain between Dawson and Katanchek, and it strains and it strains and it strains until about midway through the book when it really kind of breaks wide open. And I think that's what you're referring to when you're talking about here, Deb, finding out the truth, or at least closer to the truth, of what's actually going on. And I think Deb is just surprised and appalled, and along with Susan Wright, the CEO who comes back into the story at the midway point. Both Deb and Susan are very are stunned by what Carter and Jim Dawson have picked up here. And I think one of the interesting things about the story is that, you know, Susan, who is kind of the idol of Deb, has a very different reaction to that news than Deb does. You know, Deb has the idea that this is so awful and appalling that, you know, we've got to shut it down. It's got to change drastically. And Susan, you know, is a little bit more of a, you know, she's a little bit more of a deal maker. And she has a slightly different take on it. And her take changes how Deb feels about Susan, you know. And so that relationship between the two women changes throughout the story.
Well, I'm not going to say, I'm just crushed out one of my questions. Because if everybody found out the truth about what Elite wants to do, they probably would never go into a corporate office again. That's all I'm going to say.
Right.
No, seriously. So it comes down to greed, money, and power. That's just some of what I got. So what does CodeWise really need to succeed, and what really is Black Quest 40? Let me tell you, you'll never want to work in corporate America after this one. Let me tell you, but it's so good. Seriously.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely can't say what.
You're not going to tell us what it is. You can't. No.
Yeah. I've got a pass on that one.
Okay. So who are the people that she chooses? She has to decide who she can trust, right? Personally, I don't trust too many people in this book at all, because I'm very perceptive and I trust no one, which is really good. So who are the people that she chooses on her team, and how did you come to the technical scenes? And you did a lot of research on computer technology. I always wanted to learn how to hack into something. Did you have to learn how to do that? That must be so much fun, let me tell you.
Well, I don't really know. I mean, I'm definitely nothing like the kind of hardcore programmer that Deb is. I did work, when I lived in San Francisco, I did work for a dot-com company in San Francisco at an office building that was kind of similar in size and layout to the one that I chose for Black Quest 40, so that helped. And I know a little bit of kind of light programming, and I have access to people who are, you know, maybe not quite like Deb, but who know some programming. So I was able to, you know, fill in a lot of the gaps of things that I didn't know by talking to people in the industry. And I think, as I was mentioning before, I mean, a lot of the struggle in writing the book was going the other way. Was, you know, once you have a lot of these tech things decided and in the book, is in draft after draft making the language a little bit simpler and simplifying things to the point where an average reader would still want to go along for the ride, you know. And that was a big balance for me. It's hard when you're kind of in those scenes and you've done the research and you add the details. You know, you can lose sight of what's important and what's not important. You know, what does the reader really need to know to kind of feel what Deb feels, but also feel included in the story. So for me, it was a lot of work and kind of an education in, you know, going through beta readers and going through the whole process of drafting to make sure I had the most enjoyable story, you know, that had the right amount of authentic tech detail. Yeah.
Well, you could ask me to read something anytime. A lot of time I was a beta reader for someone, and I said, do you really want my opinion? It wasn't that the book was bad. It was the structure of the book that was not perfect. And, he's not talking to me anymore. I never write anything negative. I don't write anything nasty, and I don't pan anybody's work. If I don't like something, I just won't read it or review it, because it's not my place to take somebody's hard work and say it's not good. But it was the structure of the book and the continuity that was off, and I guess he doesn't want to know. What can I say?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd like to, from when I'm getting beta readers, I mean, I try to get a really broad range of readers. I'll even kind of actively seek out people who I don't think will like the book, you know, because, you know, I mean, you realize when you write some of the, it's not going to be for everybody. But I like to know, you know, if there are people that aren't going to like it, I like to know the way in which they're not going to like it, because there may be things that you can do at the edges to you know, kind of nuance things or to make things less abrasive for certain readers so that you can kind of cast a wider net. I mean, I, you know, like anybody else, I mean, I like everybody to like my books. I realize that there are going to be people here and there that don't.
Well, they should.
So,
you know what?
So the beta reading
if
thing
I didn't like
deal.
It, I wouldn't have agreed to do the interview. I don't interview people whose books I don't think are 5 stars. Be very honest, I'm just very bad that way. And this
well,
book really,
it's good
I mean,
for your listeners.
Yeah, but my listeners, there are people on, the phone lines are huge today. I see people listening. I don't know who they all are, but there's a lot of people listening, I could tell you that.
Good.
Okay, so
I should mention, Black Quest 40 is actually on, the e-book is on sale for 99 cents today. I should mention that, yeah.
It's one of the best, let me tell you. You never know what I'm going to do. Now, this really got me. This is fantastic because you took the opportunity to use a computer that was outdated, the great computer, Cray computer.
Right.
And why did this come to the rescue? That was really, I go like, yeah, you know, you never know when something's going to help you from the past. How come you included that? That was absolutely brilliant. I love that.
Right. So Cray supercomputers were, I guess, probably a big thing in the late 90s and 2000s. I don't know the exact timeline of that company, but they were kind of big mainframe computers. You know, think of, you know, the kind of computers that would have played chess against the chess masters and tried to beat them or something like that, you know. And so in the early days of CodeWise Solutions, the company, Carter Katanchek, who's kind of the slick marketing guy, had this idea that they could get the Cray supercomputer and, you know, use its supercomputing power to solve, you know, all these kind of problems, you know, global warming or whatever it wanted. So they had these great ambitions when they bought the Cray supercomputer, and it didn't really come to pass. They didn't really know how to use it, so they ended up kind of mothballing the computer upstairs to one of the higher floors of the office building. So as the story begins, the Cray supercomputer is kind of a joke. It's sort of a cautionary tale of their overreach, of Carter's ambition, which, of course, Carter's ambition plays into the current crisis they're in. But as the story goes on, and Deb, you know, is up against it, and they're struggling to build this software. You know, there are all kinds of technical hurdles they come up against, and there is a point later in the plot where, just like Chekhov's loaded gun in the first act, where the Cray supercomputer is going to come back into it, and hopefully kind of a fun way.
It was interesting, let me tell you. So this part was really good because not only do you have the corporate technology and elite and what's going on to the training for Black Quest 40, and you have the homeless, but you brought in something very important. Why did you include her mother in the psychiatric facility, and what's wrong with her, and why did they use that against Deb? I thought that was really clever because the only way she's going to do anything is if you figure out a way to get her to do it, even if she doesn't want to do it.
So, Deb's mother is schizophrenic, and she lives in kind of an assisted living facility in San Francisco. Deb's very involved in her care. Deb tries to go eat dinner with her most nights. And of course, she's very attached to her mother. And then, this is one of those, a little bit of an Easter egg to Die Hard, too. There's a scene in Die Hard, if people know the movie, where there's a character who's kind of a jerk, but not really like an evil person. Who does something to betray the protagonist, Bruce Willis, in that story, and Deb in this story, who does something to gain that he thinks will give him an advantage and actually really puts the protagonist in a bind. And there's a similar character in Black Quest 40 where who kind of will clue the bad guys into the fact that Deb's mother is in this facility and that Deb cares a lot about her. So there's a parallel there between the movie and the story here where you've got a character who's kind of essentially, you know, he's kind of a jerk but not really, you know, a terrible person, who makes a mistake that really puts Deb in a tough situation. And it does involve her mother, who's schizophrenic. It's a real tough scene where we see Deb, you know, it's again one of the things that pulls her back into the project. I mean, again and again, Deb pulls away from this corporate training. She doesn't want to do it. Her heart's not in it. But there are all kinds of different things throughout the story that that just keep pulling her back in, like the Godfather, you know. And in the end, her mother and her mother's welfare is the thing that pulls her back in for probably the last time in the story until we sprint to the finish.
Well, I agree. You know, my mom had Alzheimer's, and the promise I made in my book, A Daughter's Promise, is never to put her in a facility, ever. So I worry about these places. So when you say that her mother is being over-medicated and she finally realizes it, she has to do something about it because she has to stop it. So what does she do, and how does she do it? Because she's there. She can't do anything there. So how does she manage to get that done or not get it done?
Right. So that comes at the end of the story. She comes back and, you know, it is, of course, Deb is allowed out of the office finally, and we're tying up all the loose ends. I think she goes to the facility, and I think she kind of takes stock, and we can imagine that she, you know, probably spends more time with her mother after this big, you know, episode of work. You know, I think her priorities probably get shifted around a little bit. So, it's not really specified, but I think we imagine that maybe she kind of gets in their business a little bit and makes some demands about knowing exactly about dosages and things like that and wanting to make those decisions together with the people running the facility. Yeah.
I know. This is scary. So when the training is done, what does she decide to do that might change it all? Because she's clever, and what does she decide to do at the end, without giving it away, that would change it all, change everybody's perspective, maybe?
Right. Well, I think for Deb, you know, definitely Airbnb is a big part of it. You know, I think as the story ends, she realizes at several points over the course of the story that she's devoted so much of her life and her working hours to things that she's not passionate about. And, of course, you know, a lot of people, we all have to live with that, you know. I mean, everybody's got to make money. And so I think Deb, as the story ends, is not gonna settle for the amount of time on Airbnb that she had been spending, which was supposed to be something like 10 or 15% of her working hours as she worked with CodeWise. So she's definitely going to, you know, again, as I said with her mom, she's going to reassess her priorities. She's going to spend more time on Airbnb. You know, she realized, I think when you go through a thing like she goes through in this thriller, you realize that life is precious and the time here is precious. And I think she's going to spend more time with Airbnb. She's going to make it a big priority in her life. And she's going to bring other people that she cares about from the story into that endeavor. You know, she still has some reality she's got to deal with. Like, you know, she's still going to need to make some money. She's going to do something about that. And even within Airbnb, she probably realizes that some organizational structure and some, you know, some bureaucratic structures can help organizations and can help people find solutions. And so, whereas at the beginning, I think she, again, had a really go-it-alone feeling about Airbnb and solving homelessness, you know, by the end, she realizes, hey, it's a big, difficult problem. You know, I need to be more realistic about it and take a more holistic approach. And so I think her whole approach to solving problems is a lot, probably less brash. I mean, she's still Deb, but she's willing to incorporate other people's worldviews into it, I think.
Well, tell us about Cecil. Does she stay in touch with him? Because I really like that guy.
Yeah, I definitely think Cecil is one of her sort of main friends. I don't think there's any question about it. I mean, she's got some friends at work, but I think Cecil is somebody she shares a long history with. Cecil was there when she was growing up homeless, and was kind of, you can imagine him as being a little bit of a surrogate father. Her dad is not mentioned. I think her dad's not really around. And so Cecil is her partner with Airbnb, you know, with figuring out this homeless app. He's kind of her sounding board. you know, very early in the book, they have a conversation where she goes off on some technical tangent, and he says, "Speak English, Deb, regular English." You know, he's you know, I think of Cecil's a little bit her check. You know, I think, you know, Deb can kind of forget about herself a little bit and run off here and there, and I think Cecil's very grounded, and I think they're a good team that way, and I think you can imagine in another book him having a bigger role and their dynamic being, you know, in the same way that Susan and Deb had an important dynamic. So this story, you can imagine Cecil and Deb having maybe a more central role to a sequel or another story. Yeah.
Well, would she ever consider, now that she has Karen, you know, would she ever consider opening up a homeless shelter and making him in charge of it, which is more, you know, maybe safer? But then not all homeless shelters are safe. You got to be careful.
Right, right. I definitely think she would. You know, I think just in keeping with what I was saying, I think she definitely is open to a range of solutions and not just, you know, the one idea that she has. So yeah, I think that's definitely the kind of thing that we could see. I could see, you know, next book starting and talking about some of the other things that she's doing in the community with Cecil. I could see that being one of the measures. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Is she going to stay with Codewise, or is she going to go somewhere else? Because I wouldn't stay there.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Me.
I think that's a little bit to be determined. Yeah, I think, you know, as the book ends, you know, again, not to give away a whole lot of it, but she still has an association with Codewise. Of course, she has people that she managed that still work there, and she still has a relationship with Paul, and then the relationship with Susan is definitely strained. But I think, you know, it's not really addressed in the book. I think that's going to be a tough decision that she's going to have to. For some people, as you said, it wouldn't be tough. They'd just be out of there. But she's still, you know, part of the new Deb is that she's kind of accepting compromise a little bit more. She's a little bit more compromising. So I don't know. Maybe there's a role. If it works for her, then she might consider it. You know?
Well, that is good. I just got a compliment. Somebody liked my review of The Healer's Daughter by Jay Emberg. That's nice.
That is, yeah.
Once in a while I get a compliment, and once in a while they tell me whatever. I don't even care. So other than this sequel, are you going to bring back any of the characters from The Wintermaker?
Well, I don't. You know, I don't have a Wintermaker sequel on tap right now. I've got a couple other series that I'm working on. I've got one that's kind of out to literary agents right now. It's kind of a political thriller called The Pine Box Vendetta.
Nice.
So it's even another kind of genre. I mean, it's about these two warring families, the Gallaghers, who are kind of a liberal family, kind of like the Kennedys, and then the Pruitts are this conservative family. You might think of like the Bushes or something like that. And the backstory is that they've been fighting since the American Revolution. They're kind of this sort of Hatfield-McCoy back and forth political conflict. And so the story is about their fight, you know, and this would be a series, you know, about all the kind of backhanded things, you know, kind of a House of Cards style fight back and forth between the two families. So that's a book that I've finished, and it's pretty much ready to go. It's in the hands of literary agents right now, so I'm trying to figure out if I'll be trying to publish it through, if I'll be doing it through traditional publishing or kind of more of an indie route. So I've got that going. I've got some action adventure books. I actually have a separate website called thirdchancestories.com that has actually some excerpts from these. I've actually got four of them coming out. There are three very different heroes that each have, you know, prototypical sort of action hero genre traits, and they get together in a story called Anarchy of the Mice that I'm just finishing up. So now those, I think I'll definitely go the indie route because I think that's the way that those stories are more headed. So so I've got a few different things on the burner. I guess I'm kind of looking to see which ones really take off, which ones readers respond most to know, you know, where to prioritize sequels and things like that in the coming months.
Well, if you don't write a book about a terrorist attack, I mean, I'm getting tired of them. Seriously?
Yeah.
About Russia and China and Iran and Iraq. You have no idea what's sitting on my table, on my chair. I've got 27 books on my chair, and half of them are staring at me. Why aren't you reading me? I go, because I really don't want to, because I want to read something else. And that's why when I received five children's books this morning, I already read one, and I'm saying that this is really great. I'd much rather read that. So
the kids' books,
where
yeah.
can everybody find out more about you and your work? And let me tell you that Marcia Casper Cook is listening to the show. Her show is called The Good Story is a Good Story. I'm going to put you in an email with her because she would like you as a guest.
Absolutely. That would be fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, she's a riot. She's great, and you're going to love her. So I'm going to put you in an email with her afterwards, and I hope that you're going to do some more blog tours with Cheryl because they are the best. So where can everybody find out more about you and your work?
Yeah, so the best place is my website, jeffbondbooks.com, and that's got all information about all my current books that are out. And yeah, I think that you start there and just check them out. Mm-hmm.
That is great. So I want to thank you so very much. I am so excited because it's not raining. It's going to thunderstorm later. And I don't like thunderstorms. For those of you that missed my show 2 weeks ago, Brian Brisby is a meteorologist. And he wrote a book called The Wonderful World of Weather for Kids. And I learned a lot about thunderstorms, rainstorms, and lightning. And a whole bunch of things about the weather. The show was really good, and the book is adorable for little kids. They'll never go out in a storm again. But he wrote it about a true story, about being scared of a thunderstorm. And by the time I got done, I didn't feel as scared. It was great. So for those of you that want to read some great books, Black Quest 40 is fantastic. An Eye for a Lie is really interesting. Old Bones by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child is, oh, my God. The 3 Hours is really very, very, is a very, very sad book that I just read by Rosalind and Hellstrom, and One Good Deed by David Baldacci, and that's just last week. Then there's this week as to what I'm reading. High Stakes by John Dobbin and a few others, Capital White by John Land and Donnie Brasco. And that's just a few of what a friend is reading. But I want to thank you so very much. Everybody, have a beautiful day. Jeff, thank you. And I hope you come on again when you get the next book. Do you think, when is the next one coming out? Do you have any idea?
I would think the third chance story, the action adventure stories, ought to be kind of January, February 2020 range, yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, just let
and
me
I'll
know.
And I'll definitely be in touch through Cheryl, definitely.
I know you will, because they do the best job. And for those of you that don't know, Silent Voices is going on blog tour. Anybody that wants to join and wants something wonderful and lovely and kind, the tour is from September 1st to September 30th. The title of the book is Silent Voices by guess who, me, Fran Lewis, and I hope everybody reads it. Everybody have a nice day. Thank you, Jeff, everybody, and bye.
Thank you so much, Fran. Bye.